Say good evening to everybody. Appreciate your tearing yourself away from the presidential debate to be here with us tonight. And I hope everybody realizes that of this activity and that activity, this one will make more difference in the long run. And we're very glad to be together to remember the Lord tonight. It seems like 100 years since I got to study from the prophets with you as we were doing. It's been only, in my terms, it's been only 4 or 5 weeks. But in terms of the prophets and their years, it actually has been 100 years. The last one of the prophets we got to consider together was Zephaniah, who did his work about 620 B.C. in the years that were just leading up to the captivity off in Babylon, and the warnings that were being offered by him. And now we come to events that happen about 520 B.C. In fact, exactly in the year 520 B.C., and not only that, a message that is contained in four sayings of a prophet that take place from late August and mid-December of that year. We know some things about the circumstances in which this all happened because the background, historically speaking, is laid out for us in chapters 3 through 7 of the book of Ezra. So there are several details that we have, more information about the goings-on and the background of this prophet than some of the others we have read together. I'm glad that we can pick back up with a success story. And not only that, but a preacher success story. Those are rare. And they were rare in the days of the prophets too. If you think back to the fellows whose messages that we have read, these great men carried messages that warned of disasters that were going to be faced in terms of judgment against evil. Men who had messages which with a broken heart they presented that convicted their countrymen or people of other lands of terrible sins and wrongs and of the consequences of them. Sometimes these men had to explain great disasters like famines or other kinds of events that brought suffering into the lives of people, and they had to explain why these things were happening. With many of these men, their messages have been ignored. Sometimes the men have been mistreated, and they have not lived to see any good particularly come from what they've said. Wouldn't that be a hard burden to bear? But we know from Ezra chapter 6 that with Haggai and Zechariah, their preaching worked. More specifically, the people who heard their preaching worked. Their messages were heeded and their messages made a difference for good. And the people got to see the blessing that came from obeying the Lord's word. In this case, I especially am grateful that what we are able to learn from Haggai is that encouragement works. Encouragement, even in terrible and difficult times, works. The Lord does not leave His people with only notice of the mistakes they've made and the wrongs they've done. He doesn't leave His people with only warnings about what will happen to them if they don't change. He doesn't leave His people only with descriptions of why terrible things have been experienced by them. He also encourages them. And that's something that we need to think about, why God does it. This one starts, maybe we can describe it this way, with a question for us. What are the Lord's people to do when the kinds of things go on that have happened as we've read through the minor prophets? You know, now we go back about 230 years before where we are now, and we follow the events as they unfold from the middle of the 8th century B.C. down to where we are now in the 6th century. And I've tried to just summarize in my mind the things that happened during this period of time. There has been international upheaval. First the Assyrian Empire, and then the Babylonians, and now the Persians are in power. And not only those foreign nations, but Israel, the northern kingdom, has descended into idolatry and been carried away. And now the southern kingdom has had Jerusalem and the temple destroyed, and they've been taken captive themselves into a foreign land. This has been a time of natural disasters. You remember Joel's locust plagues, or the kinds of droughts and so forth that Amos called attention to during his period of time, or other events like that, the political intrigue and injustice that occurred during this period of time. Bad guys got the power sometimes and kept it for the longest period of time. I think about Manasseh in the southern kingdom. And then in the northern kingdom, these guys who were supposed to be leading tribes of God's people started killing each other off. Sometimes dying in the palace itself at the hands of their kinfolks. There's about 7 different changes of dynasty in the northern kingdom during this time where the ruling family is knocked off and somebody else rules for 3 months or so. In one case, 1 week. And something happens to them like that. There's moral and spiritual failure among Israel, the Israelites and the people of Judah themselves. And terrible kinds of things, so much so that it gets to where you don't even want to trust your brother or sister or your own neighbor among God's people. And then there have been vocal opponents. Remember when Hezekiah's letter when Hezekiah read the Assyrian captain's letter and the warnings and all of that that went on. There have been stuff like that, people like that who tried to make fun of the God served by the Israelites. What are God's people to do in the midst of those kinds of things? Go back, Linda, to that, if you would. While that's before you here, I want now to take a moment to describe where we are in Haggai's time. When Haggai lives, or when this event happens in 530 B.C., what has happened is that the Persians and the Medes have taken power from the Babylonians, taking the city of Babylon without even a battle being fought. And Cyrus the Great has now seized the authority, and he's ruling over the Persian kingdom. 2 years after Cyrus took power in 538 B.C., and 2 years later in 536, he had been looking through the records and he discovered the people that were there. He pursued a different means of maintaining order in the empire than the Babylonians have. He allowed the captives to go back to their own lands and to worship their gods and so forth. So what Cyrus does is to allow any of the Jews who want to do so, who are willing to do so, to go back to Jerusalem and to rebuild the temple of the Lord their God and to serve him there. And many of the people who were led by Zerubbabel, the grandson of the Jeconiah, the king of Jehoiakim, I should say, Jeconiah also called, who was carried off into Babylonian captivity. He leads a fairly large number of the people back to Jerusalem. And when they get there in 536, they build up the altar to the Lord, and they lay the foundation of the temple, which was a huge step because the temple was an expression of the covenant that God had with the Jews, that God had with the people. And the covenant loyalty that they had was expressed to God by the service that would have gone on at the temple, the sacrifices offered there, and so forth. God's presence, God's covenant presence with his people, in their mind, would be expressed by the presence of the temple and the service that went on there, his glory among them, and the new life of the people, the fact that they had returned from captivity would be expressed not just by return to the land, but by the temple being functional and by them expressing their obedience to the law in that way. They made a great start. But what happens is some of the people of the land now don't like it. They send messages back to the king in Persia. By the way, there's a change of rulership that goes on there about this time. But the message is sent back. These Jews have a long history of rebellion. If you let them build their temple and do as they intend, it's going to be trouble for you. They are certain to not submit to you, and it will cause war. So the king sends word back for them to stop, and they just stop, and things lie there that way for 16 years. Any of you who know anything about the idea of inertia know that it's hard to restart something which has been stopped under threat. That progress is hard to gain in a situation like that. And that's what happens here. So what are the Lord's people to do in that situation? We might find ourselves asking something like that when we look at our society today. Did you know that? Some of you may be sitting here right now wondering about the election and all that kind of stuff and what's going to happen, what are we going to do, what should we do, all that kind of thing. Maybe the answer in this book is relevant, more so than we think. You know what Haggai's answer? Actually, it's not Haggai's answer. It's the Lord's answer. You know what the answer is? Build the Lord's house. That's this whole little book has that message almost shouted out. That's the point of the whole thing. Build the Lord's house. And I remember to understand this, what I just said. It's not about the building that they were trying to build. The Lord was not confined to whatever kind of house they could build. What's at stake here, again, is the expression of covenant loyalty. For us, the parallel would be the Lord's Supper that we kept this morning to remind us on the first day of the week whose we are and what we're about. That's the kind of thing. Build the Lord's cause. Give yourself to improving the Lord's cause. Attend to the Lord's honor. Pay attention to your loyalty to God. And that idea would be here in this passage. Now, The way in which, I didn't get this fixed so that the ideas would come up one at a time, but I'm going to ask you to think about them one at a time. The way in which this encouragement, I'll call it, takes place is interesting. He doesn't just say, God sent you people back to the land to build the temple, and you haven't done it. You've been falling short. Wake up. I'm going to send you back if you don't. What he does is to say, who have you folks been listening to? Have you been listening to the enemies? Have you been listening to your own doubts and fears? Is your own self-talk echoing in your mind and causing you to say, it's better to leave things like they are than it is to risk what might happen if we try to move the Lord's cause forward? In this little book, the key phrase is, the word of the Lord came by. And there are 38 verses here, and I believe I read that there are in 22 different occasions in these 38 verses, that either the word of the Lord came by, or thus says the Lord, or some such statement like that by the prophet occurs here. What the message would be, are we listening to the Lord or someone else? Are we paying attention to what he says or somebody else? It's hard not to listen to somebody else when there are people around who are saying, we're going to tell the king if you try to build that temple, that type of thing. Second question would be, how have things been working for you? I left off a question maybe to start with. How have things been working for you? The second key phrase in this little book is, consider your ways. And you'll notice that it appears first maybe in verse 7, no, verse 5. And notice what happens here is he says, you've sown much, and consider your ways. You've sown much, you've harvested little, you eat, but you never have enough. In other words, you never fulfilled. You drink, but you never have your fill. You clothe yourselves, no one's warm. He who earns wages does so to put them into a bag with holes. I've felt that way before, haven't you? What he's saying is, you all have been here in the land, and you've been doing stuff that hasn't moved you forward. It hasn't satisfied you. It hasn't gotten you anywhere. And when he comes down to verse 7, he brings up that phrase again, consider your ways. He says, go up to the hills and bring wood and build the house, that I may take pleasure in it and that I may be glorified, says the Lord. You looked for much, and behold, it came to little. And when you brought it home, I blew it away. Why, declares the Lord? Because of my house that lies in ruins, while each of you busies himself with his own house. He says, therefore, the heavens have withheld the dew, and the earth has withheld its produce. And I've called for a drought on the land and the hills and the grain and the new wine and on the oil and on what the ground brings forth, on man and beast and on all that labors. Remember again, the Lord wasn't looking for a place to live. What he's concerned with is the priorities of his people. They've gotten to the place where they are satisfied to let the cause of the Lord languish, as long as they themselves have it as they want it. That's a perpetual human problem. Who would have thought that in a world with all of those kind of problems I mentioned a moment ago, with with regard to the nations and the natural world and the political system and so forth, who would have thought that the real problem existed in the priorities of God's people? Third thing, third step toward encouragement here is, where can you begin to change? Anybody can point out the problems unless he's just so self-satisfied he's willfully blind. Anybody could do that. But how? Where is the hinge found between knowing that something needs to be done and it being done? Somebody has to start somewhere. The question is, who's somebody and where's the somewhere? And look at verse 12. Then Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, he's the civil leader, and Joshua, the son of Jehozadak, he's the high priest, he's the religious leader, and all the remnant of the people, the ones who were left, the ones who cared, obeyed the voice of the Lord their God and the words of Haggai the prophet. The Lord their God had sent them, and the people feared the Lord. They started doing what they could to act on what the Lord said. They started. Specific people started doing something to try to build up the house of the Lord or to renew covenant loyalty, to strengthen the honor of God. And the fourth question in the encouragement process is, what will be the source of your strength? And notice in verse 13 of chapter 1, that once they obeyed the voice of their God, Haggai, the messenger of the Lord, spoke to the people with the Lord's message, "I'm with you," declares the Lord. Where had they been getting their strength before? Well, they didn't have any. They thought it depended on what their enemies in the land said. Where are they going to get it now? Well, not simply from their own hands, but the Lord will be with them while they're doing what He says. And as far as I can tell, that's a principle that never has changed. The Lord is still with His people when they're doing what He says. Our offering of encouragement, and as I said, I've left one off here, personally speaking, even, involves this, what we communicate to each other. Who have you been listening to? Who are you listening to? What's the connection, the basis upon which I offer encouragement? How's it been working for you? Where are you going to begin to make it different? And where will you get the power to do it? You have to answer those four questions to offer encouragement to somebody. Now, in this book, encouragement meets the inevitable. Why is encouragement needed? Well, because there are things that people think, that even God's people think, that keep them from acting on these questions. So what are the things that encouragement has to overcome? In this letter, there are interesting answers to that question. And you notice that encouragement overcomes here in the main stories of this book. The first one is found in chapter 1, really, in verse 2 and 3 and following. It's not a good time. You ever heard that one? It's not a good... The excuses that are conquered by encouragement are, first, the idea that it's not a good time. Time's not right. And another way of saying that is, we should do that later. Or we will when we get around to it. That's my language. I know those phrases. I can't right now. I know that sometimes there are reasons for that, but remember what they're saying this about. They're saying this about their responsibility to the Lord. When is a good time to attend to your responsibility to the Lord? The answer is always right now, isn't it? So Haggai just deals with it by just raising gently a question. Is it the right time for the Lord's house to lie in shambles and you to dwell in your fancy houses? Good roofs, nice walls. Is it a good time for that? How would you answer that question? Maybe like they did. Why do you think they got up and got started? They didn't think that was appropriate either. The second thing that encouragement has to overcome is our people are discouraged. Right now, we're just faint-hearted. We're just downhearted. We're not making much of a difference. When they laid the foundation of this new temple, there were some guys around, Ezra tells us, who were still old enough to remember the temple that had been wiped out. The glorious temple that Solomon built took how many hundreds or thousands of people to build it over 7 years with all that gold and all the finery and the amazing that temple. Now this one comes back and it's just made out of whatever material I suppose was at hand and small and not impressive at all, the people were, God even knew. Verse 3 of chapter 2, is it not as nothing in your eyes? Is our work together like that to you? Ever? I think we find ourselves, we're bound to in that spot at one time or another. So what the Lord has Haggai to say to the civil leader and religious leader in verse 4, at the end of the verse, be strong, all your people of the land, declares the Lord, work, for I'm with you, declares the Lord of hosts, according to the covenant that I made with you when you came out of Egypt. My spirit remains in your midst. Fear not. And then he says that in verse 9, the latter glory of this house shall be greater again, or greater than the former, says the Lord of hosts, verse 9. Now, the verses in between, in verses 6 and 7 and 8, mention the shaking of the kingdoms and the glory being brought, their treasures being brought into this house. That happens literally in Ezra, in chapter 7, when King Artaxerxes of Persia allowed Ezra to have the other peoples around give all the money that was needed for anything necessary in the rebuilding of the Lord's temple. That was treasures from the lands. And then the Hebrew writer uses this in Hebrews 12 in verses 25 and 26 to talk about the glory of the Lord's kingdom, in which there are people from all nations who've been redeemed through the work of Christ and the message of the gospel. This everlasting kingdom will not be shaken, and we ought to be thankful for that and serve the Lord with gratitude because of it. The third thing that has to be overcome here is the idea the nation is unclean. This would be chapter 2 and verses 10 and following, and once again, we might ask ourselves whether we blame the supposed inability of the church on how things are going in America these days. We mustn't let that happen. In this case, in Haggai, the prophet is sent to ask the people, the priest and so forth, a question about the law. If someone carries what's holy and it touches something that's unclean, or he touches some other material or object, does that make that holy? No, holiness is not transferable. On the other hand, if someone who is unclean comes in contact with other persons and so forth, will that make the other persons unclean? The answer is yes. And so in verses 14 and following, Haggai says it's that way with this people. I'm the one. He makes the point that what's been happening is you've been touched and you've become unclean. But since you started doing what I gave you to do, you've been holy. And you'll be holy. And I'll bless you. And I'm summarizing for time's sake here in saying this, but this would be verses 18 and 19. From this day forward, he names the day. The foundation of the Lord's temple was laid. Consider. And then he talks about, is the seed yet in the barn? Indeed, the vine, the fig tree, the pomegranate, the olive, have yielded nothing. But from this day on, I'll bless you. Don't worry about what the nation has been in the past or the circumstances around. If you will listen and do what I called you to do, I'll bless you, he says. So the I'm with you, I will be with you, and I will bless you theme is emphasized here. And then the fourth thing, there's no one to lead us. Back in Jeremiah 22, Jeremiah had announced for the Lord that he was removing the signet ring from the supposed descendants of David who were exercising power in Jerusalem at that time, the time when the captivity happened. Jeremiah 22, about verses 17 and 18, as I recall. Might be 7 and 8. You look it up. It's in that chapter, though. Now what's happening is God says to this descendant of David, Zerubbabel, my servant, last verse of this book, I'll take you, O Zerubbabel, my servant, the son of Shealtiel, declares the Lord, and I'll make you like a signet ring, for I have chosen you, declares the Lord of hosts. I'll bless the man who leads you in doing what I say. That's the idea. Now, Zerubbabel becomes important in Matthew chapter 1, verses 12, 13, 14, long in there, he's the one through whom the line of David continues, and finally the Christ comes, and God's power to rule over his kingdom takes place, and so on. The encouragement works. The people, after 3 weeks of hearing Haggai begin again after 16 years of inactivity to attend to the task at hand, and within 4 years, Ezra tells us, the job was done. The people rejoiced over it. One of the things the New Testament tells us, 1 Thessalonians 5 and verse 14, is encourage the faint-hearted. We know also from wisdom, from Proverbs, and from human experience that finding a word fitly spoken to do that is not easy. Perhaps we can find some clues in that way from the little book of Haggai. And some encouragement for us to act on the encouragement of the call of the Lord's Word ourselves. If you're here tonight, the first step is to do what you know you need to do. If you know you need to become a Christian and you've been intending to do that, this is a good time. If we can help you, we'd love to do that. If you'll come, while we stand and sing together.